rock, too.
Ready to go?
Except Kathleen just stepped out, so.
Meeting of the State Government Budget Division for January 7th, 2009. I don't plan on taking any votes today, but we do have a quorum present. Welcome back, everybody. We have a few minor changes to the Budget Division. Senator Dan Morrison, of course, retired from the Senate, so he was on the Budget Division, and he's not replaced. It's a little difficult to make changes midterm as we are right now. When new senators come on and they don't necessarily want their predecessors' committee assignments, and it's kind of hard to make other movements when people are already locked in their committee assignments. So we'll just be down. We're down to eight people. We have, as far as staff goes, Catherine Lonergan is continuing on as the Budget Division Administrator, and of course Tom Bodden and Kevin Lundeen are the Senate Counsel and Fiscal Analysts. I do have a new legislative assistant who's going to be the secretary for the Budget Division. Amos Bragg joined us recently. And is Carolyn back there? Yeah, she's back there. My former L.A. is sitting back there, but she, as we say, went over the dark side. So she's now with Meserly and Kramer. So welcome back, Carolyn. And I don't know, other staff, we have the normal staff here. Are you? Same as before, right? So, okay. So everybody still is back to normal. Since we are midterm, we're not going to be spending a lot of time this session going through the overview things and the things we already know about, but because we do have the budget issues to deal with, I do want to spend a little bit more time going deeper into some of the areas and finding out a few more things that maybe that we hadn't spent a lot of time on the last 2 years so that we can be prepared when our share of the budget solutions come. So I want to start this afternoon. Kevin Lundeen, our fiscal analyst, can kind of give us just a quick overview, and I believe you do have a handout in here to kind of give you a refresher as to just where the money is within our budget area and some of the issues that we may have to be looking at. So, Kevin?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, there's a four-page handout you should have, and this is just to kind of take a higher level look and just kind of maybe put a little more focus on some of the non-general funds that this committee has jurisdiction over. If you look at the first page, it's just kind of a simple pie chart where I've just kind of divided out the general fund from the all other funds that are in the jurisdiction of this budget division. And if you turn over to the second page, yourself of the general fund dollars that we do have, I've kind of broken it out kind of in a high level, and these are the biennial numbers. We do have a total general fund budget here of about a little over $624 million. And then if you turn to the next page, you can get a look at, I just kind of highlighted a few of the bigger non-general fund items. And as you saw from the chart, it was about $8.9, almost $9 billion, and the majority of that was the pension funds. That was about almost $7 billion. But some of the smaller portions of that, looking at after that, are the state employee group insurance program, which is about $1.4 billion. The Department of Administration Internal Service Funds, which are about $215 million, and we'll be hearing more about those after this presentation. And I believe next week we'll be hearing from the Office of Technology. They also have a number of internal service funds that are about $184 million. excuse me. And then just taking a look at the state lottery operating expenses, that's about $57 million. And that's just the operating expenses. That's not the lottery proceeds. Another big item is the employee medical, dental, transit, and dependent care pre-tax. That's basically flows through the Department of Management and Budget, and a little portion of that is in the legislature as well. Another bigger non-general fund item is in the Office of Administrative Hearings. They have a revolving fund where agencies and local governments pay for the hearings that they have, And then we also do make a direct appropriation for the workers' compensation judges out of the workers' compensation fund. Another bigger item is the Attorney General. In addition to the general fund appropriation that we give them, they also have partner agreements with state agencies, and they total somewhere in the neighborhood of about $12 million for the biennium. Another bigger item is with the Minnesota Management and Budget. They have a statewide systems billing of about $11 million for the biennium. And that's basically charges out to the state agencies to pay for the use of the maps and accounting system and those sorts of things. And then another bigger item of about $6 million in special revenue is the appropriation that we make to the Gambling Control Board. These are their fees and that are dedicated in a special revenue fund, and then we do make an appropriation for their operating budget. And then the last item that I have listed here is the Racing Commission's operating budget, where a portion of it is statutorily appropriated to them, and another portion we do directly appropriate to the Racing Commission for their operating budget. And then kind of making up the remainder is, you know, there's federal dollars and a number of just smaller statutory and some smaller direct appropriations. But so basically the idea here was just to kind of, you know, give you a broad overview of some of the other dollars that flow through this committee that we maybe don't always talk about as much, but and that are outside of the general fund.
For instance, on the last page, the base, the bill that we put together, you know, the last 2 years didn't show these numbers because we automatically assume these numbers are there, right? I mean, they're there. We just don't see them because it's just ongoing things. So, you know, it doesn't say you couldn't go back in and change them, but those are the ones we normally don't think about because it's just things we assume are ongoing. But maybe these things are, you know, there's a reason for every one of them. They may be on, you know, have to be looked at again a little closer in depth this year. So, do you have any questions overall about the just the general areas? We're going to be, again, looking at more of these more specifically as we get our budget issues to us, but this is a kind of an overview of where we're at. Sergeant Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to pick on any one group or anything, but I just was looking through this and just as a point of question, state lottery, for example, operating expenses. Are those any things we've ever looked at, or do we tend to look at departments first in terms of where we can save money, where we can decrease budget? And like I said, I just happened to pick that one out, but do we ever specifically look at can we operate more efficiently, can we do better in those type of things?
Because sure. We bring these organizations and groups in there. We've typically not been looking at their base budgets because, as I say, normally those are just kind of built in and figuring, well, that's what they need to operate. But now I guess, you know, that's the challenge we have before us. Maybe we have to start looking at, you know, base budgets. And there's a reason for every one of those that's on here, but with the deficit we've got facing and the long-term issues, maybe that's why we're going to have to start asking those very questions as to, you know, what they're costing and, you know, what they need to do. Of course, everyone's going to justify, you know, the biggest one, pension funds. I suppose you could pay less of the pension funds, but then there's going to be a huge backlash, you know, if that happens. But that's a lot of money, $6.7 billion. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, as I'm thinking about the general market, every business in Minnesota has had to reorganize their structure and rethink you know, mm-hmm. who they're paying and their management and things. And so I guess it's my opinion that nothing should be off the table and we should make everybody rethink how they're doing things to go into this long term, because coming in here in 2003 when we faced a big deficit, you know, and now in 2009 as a legislator, I'd rather work on some of these things structurally and get everybody to rethink the organization in terms of Minnesota in a future vision so that we don't have to keep coming back and facing these kind of crisis situations.
Well, that's how we're providing the information to you so we can start thinking about those very things. So, Senator Coobley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, you know, just one comment, I guess, on the pension thing. It seems to me that we're not really doing ourselves any favors if we cut pensions to the point where people can't afford health care and that kind of thing, and then they end up on a different level of government, that really isn't very helpful. You know, that's just for, you know, a point of information, I suppose. But, you know, it seems to me that that has happened with some companies as they've, you know, downgraded the retirement benefits that they pay to their retired employees. But I did have a question for Mr. Lundin, and it's kind of a small part of the budget, but where does the oversight or the funding fall? You know, does it come under this committee or another committee for the smaller groups that the state funds, like the barbers and cosmetology and boxing, and, you know, there's a lot of different commission kinds of things. Is that under this, under the jurisdiction of this committee, or is that
some
another?
Mr. Lundin?
Yeah, we do have jurisdiction for some. We don't have for the Barbers Board. We have the
Campaign Finance Board,
the CAP Board, the Amateur Sports Commission, and we do have the ethnic councils, you know, Black Minnesotans and those groups. But
Indian Affairs,
yeah.
Not a lot of money there, though. I mean,
no.
These small groups, it isn't.
Yeah. They're pretty small, yeah. But I was just wondering, jurisdictionally, where do those things fall? So the ones that aren't under this committee, Mr. Lundin, where do those... Where is the responsibility for their...
I believe like the Barbers Board and those would be falling probably in the Economic Development Division, and then any of the health-related boards would be in Senator Berglund's committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions about just the... We're going to be visiting a lot of this stuff in more in-depth, you know, in the next few weeks, but we want to start with a snapshot to see where we're going. Anything else? Okay, well... let's move on then. We're going to start with the Department of Administration, and I've asked Commissioner Badger to join us and kind of go through what they have in their budget areas and some of the things that you know they're looking at, and just give us kind of an update. Some good news, some bad news, some questionable news, I guess. But Commissioner, welcome back, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm delighted to be back. I'm glad to have you back. We're going to have a very interesting number of months here working together, so we might as well start off looking at some money issues right away. At the request of the chair, I'm going to cover here this morning, generally speaking, the piece that isn't subject to general fund reduction, that is the internal service funds, the piece that Mr. Lundin was just showing is a substantial amount of money in the Department of Administration. If you'll turn to your first page, kind of the counterpart to Mr. Lundin's chart in that it breaks out the entire budget of the Department of Administration into various kinds of funds. And you'll see that $214 million, close to the same number as Mr. Lundin had, is in fact internal service funds, and that's what I'm going to focus on here this morning. But you'll also see special revenue and federal funds. You'll see a substantial number of grants, which are public broadcasting and other kinds of grants. We do get federal funds for our developmental disabilities and STAR councils and so forth. But again, this morning, I'm not yet allowed to talk about the general fund, so I'm going to talk this morning about the internal service funds this afternoon.
And that's just basically a way of saying that a lot of agencies pay administration,
yes,
and there's money that goes back and forth, and
yes,
maybe the other budget divisions aren't looking at that, but I think we have, at least have to pay attention to what money is flowing back and forth between the agencies, and that's what these funds do.
Mr. Chair, exactly. Let me just start by saying I think this session you're going to hear a relatively new term in a number of contexts, that is shared services. There was a press conference the governor held this morning around shared services in K-12 education. In a sense, the Department of Administration has been doing shared services for years, and that we provide general services to state agencies, usually for a fee. And we do the things because we have economy of scale and skill, and we can do them centrally, thus enabling them to free up their time to concentrate on their frontline mission. So, for example, again, we manage their real property, we manage their leases, their fleet, their purchasing, and so forth. So let me just say that our customers, and we treat each of these internal service funds as a standalone business. We have business disciplines in the Department of Administration that require each of these businesses to submit a business plan every year. It is in writing. It's quite detailed. Mr. Lundin has access to all of those. That business plan includes a number of features. What are the products and services of that group? What's the financial outlook? What are the inflationary pressures? What are the customer demands? What kind of private sector rates, if this work were to be done outside of state government, what would it cost? Expected impact of pricing. We do a rate matrix because some of these funds offer a number of different kinds of services. And we do a six-year backward look at rate comparisons to see what kinds of trends in increases or decreases we've had. Now, that business plan gets reviewed by our executive team and then is submitted to the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget for approval. So all of our rates, which we then charge to state agencies, are approved by finance. Now, this year, even last fall or last spring, we knew we were having difficulties. We took a 3% reduction in our general fund. You all remember those times. We challenged each of our business plans to come back with business plans that absorbed fully inflation. In other words, to propose to us at worst a no-increase kind of plan. And I know that was more difficult for some plans than others, but we did, generally speaking, succeed in having no rate increases, and I'll talk about the couple of exceptions here in a moment, to any state agency for any of our services. So if you will then go to the very first one, we're going to talk about not every single one of these. There are a few small plans, few small businesses, repair and other jobs. If you need your key made for your office, that group comes and does that for a small fee. The movers, if you need to have office things moved around. We don't include these businesses here because they're relatively small, but I do want to include the big ones because that's where all the big dollars are. I think you all know that we manage 21 buildings in the Capitol Complex plus the BCA building. And in return for our management costs are then charged to the state agencies that occupy those spaces, with the exception, of course, of the legislature and the veterans whose leases or rent is paid through a general fund in lieu of rent appropriation. So we maintain these buildings, and so we have all the normal costs of operating 21, sometimes old and sometimes new, energy-efficient buildings. We obviously have housekeeping, daily housekeeping services. Snow removal is a big one this winter particularly. Engineering, so all of the engineering systems that are in each of these buildings, including heat and ventilating and air conditioning and other systems, are maintained by engineers on our staff. Obviously, there are always minor repairs. We do take the trash out. We provide utilities and so forth. I think I mentioned here our customers are the state agencies, the legislatures, the court, and the historical society because we maintain the History Center. Under lease agreements, these are written lease agreements, just as you would find in the private sector, with standards of care set and lease rates, which do vary by building. The lease rates are set based on the particular expenses associated with the building, the amount of bond interest that still is remaining that has to be paid off. So these are full recovery cost leases, including the initial investment in the building. That amount is, total amount of that fund is $63.7 million. And it comprised of the following items that you'll see on the chart, $17.4 million in bond interest and building depreciation. $13.2 million of that gets returned to the general fund. There is a debt service amount. Utilities are a big cost. You know that from your own home. They're $10.7 million simply for utilities in these buildings. And then operating expenses, which include all of the personnel and supplies and so forth, are the remaining $20.8 million. Let me just kind of orient you to these charts. I should have done that, first of all. On each of these charts, I'm going to follow a consistent format, the name of the business. And in the upper left hand is a description of the business. I'll go down from that and give you the numbers, the dollars associated with it. The third block, which I'll discuss now, are what are some of the economic impacts that are being felt in those businesses. And then finally, what is the business doing to save money? How are they controlling costs? Because every penny that we incur gets passed on to another state agency and is somehow impacting their operating budgets. So we're obviously very mindful of our impact on state agencies. But I will say one more thing editorially, which is when you look at a shared service, typically we are doing things with better, as I mentioned, economy of scale and skill that prevents, that enables agencies not to have to worry about those things. So, for example, in our leasing area, we're taking care of the buildings for the people. They would otherwise have to contract for those services or somehow or another arrange to have those things done. We think at greater cost, and we think with certainly more management attention.
Okay, Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Badgerow, of these 21 buildings, are those things like Commerce and DNR, and but those are not state buildings, correct? We're leasing them.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, the 21 buildings we're talking about here are state-owned buildings, largely in the Capitol Complex, extending south to the History Center. Obviously, Centennial Office Building, MnDOT Building, the Administration Building, the State Capitol. BCA Building is over on Maryland in St. Paul. But those are all state-owned buildings. Buildings, we have another section of Department of Administration, which is generally funded. We'll talk about that when we talk about the budget. That does negotiate all of those leases, those over on Lafayette that you mentioned, DNR and PCA and Labor and Industry, negotiates the leases in downtown St. Paul and elsewhere throughout the state. In fact, we have over 5,000 leases that we are managing for state agencies.
Just a quick follow-up. Have you found over time, is it better or more cost-effective for the state to own a building or to lease them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, a study was done some years ago. I suspect the conclusion would still be the same, that it is cheaper for the state to own its buildings because we can do one thing better than the private sector, which is borrow money. We can borrow money at cheaper rates. And so when the cost of money is factored in, the operating costs probably tend to be a wash. Utility costs are going to be roughly the same. But the basic infrastructure purchase price, lease cost, cost of money, is more favorable with the government.
And a couple of years ago, we ran into a situation where a lot of the Department of Revenue was across the river, and we were running into some real significant problems in that lease. And so we hurriedly built a very wonderful revenue building a few blocks away from here. But, boy, that was a challenge for a time being, trying to get that issue resolved. That was a big problem with the legislature. Mr. Olsen?
Well, are there any of these that are on, like, a lease purchase so that at the end of the lease the state owns them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, not that I know of. Now, we do have some unusual financing arrangements on the Anderson Building, which was and is it the Ag Building as well?
The Freeman Building as well.
We're done with the Port Authority helped finance those. So it's an unusual kind of situation there, and I wouldn't say there's a Port Authority ownership, but there's certainly a Port Authority interest in the building should we not pay our rent or should we not pay the debt service.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, Commissioner, proceed.
Well, just continuing on with leases, there were a few increases, as you'll see, but they were overall less than 1%, and this is a case where we have to charge out our full cost recovery. And in certain cases, particularly the Ag Health Lab, it turned out that the energy usage in that building has been significantly higher than was originally planned, and that does affect their lease rate. So when I say that lease rates were 1% on average higher, it takes into account things like that. But what happens when we have a downturn is actually this, it does impact this building, this building fund. Because, for example, if there's vacant space, if an agency is merged with another and leaves space vacant, or if they downsize a significant amount of their staff and leaves that space vacant, we continue to have to pay the expenses of that, and there's no agency from whom to collect the rent. So there is that impact. We have to manage carefully our occupancy rates in all of our buildings. So as we come across a space in the Centennial Office Building, for example, that's vacant, we're looking hard out and about in the private sector for where we have people in private lease spaces that we might be able to move into that state property so that we can absorb all of the costs. Let me just say in cost containment, I think we've had some pretty good experience in cost containment here. They're down 4.3 FTEs. The energy consumption, you may know that the governor issued an executive order a couple of years ago requiring us to try to reduce energy consumption 10% in all state-owned buildings. Thus far, we've been able to reduce the Capitol Complex buildings by 3.4%. That has saved $375,000. And then we have a number of measures for increased productivity in that group. Throughout the Department of Administration, this year we have a goal to reduce non-FMLA sick leave, the incidental kind of sick leave. We're managing it very closely. And just by paying attention to it in management, we were able to reduce that sick leave time 6% in this particular group. I hope I'm not creating that feedback.
No, it's
okay, it's not feedback. Good.
That's the first Wednesday of the month.
Thank you. Similarly, with close management, you know, to point to Senator Jungbauer's point, you know, management has to pay attention to a lot of these things, and we have been paying much more attention to our safety practices. Now, these are maintenance engineers and plant management employees who do run into kind of hazardous kinds of situations, lifting. And so by paying attention to our safety practices and actually putting in place more safety prevention measures, we've been able to reduce our injury loss time by 12.5%. And anytime we have somebody off the job, we're having to compensate for that with someone else filling in. And then we have a wonderful success story in our work order productivity. That means when you call plant management to come fix something and replace the light bulbs or something else, we have a work order system. And we have put in place a system by which we have increased the productivity on those work orders, not 10%, not 20%, but 100%. So that obviously is reducing costs for those particular work orders. So that takes care of it for leases. I guess maybe I'll take questions as we go on each of these areas.
I've got one overall question, and we're going to go, you're going to go obviously into a lot of specific areas, but generally you've tried to maintain the flat fees basically because the agencies are strapped for money. They, even if you wanted to raise the fees, they don't have it to give to you. Is that starting to affect the quality of the services that the agencies or you or anybody can provide because you're limited now as to just, you know, the money that you're getting and what you're able to provide in return?
You know, I'd have to say that in general, our quality of service has been maintained at a pretty high level. One other thing I didn't mention is that when we do treat agencies as customers, we do customer surveys, just as you would in the private sector, and they're fairly rigorous third-party customer surveys administered by the Management Analysis Division. And those customer surveys tell us whether or not our service is slipping. In each of our buildings, for example, we do periodic building surveys of the occupants. Are you satisfied with the responsiveness of plant management? Are you satisfied with your lighting, your heat, your air conditioning, the cafeteria? And so we've consistently been getting consistently term over term improvements in our customer service ratings for all of our businesses.
Let me just pose one question that just happened to come to my attention in regards to this building here. Of course, I think you provide. There's cleaning services provided through this building, and they do the things that keep this place clean and presentable. But during the legislative session, of course, there's more demand because there's everybody showing up here all the time, and apparently they're not able to get more temporary cleaning services people here during this coming session as in the past. So basically the crew that we've got is a crew that's here the rest of the year, but no more, and I don't know whether that's going to affect the ability to, you know, because there's more demands. I don't know if that's something that we're looking at here or not. So.
Well, let's ask Dave Fielding, our Plant Management Director.
Division. Thank you. I'm Dave Fielding, Director of Plant Management Division. Senator, the positions you're referring to are what we refer to as the variable staffing that does come with session. And those positions, it's not that we can't fill them or find people to fill them, but the Department of Administration goes through a pretty rigorous review of all open positions, and that is where we are at this point in time in reviewing those open positions and seeking authority to fill. Once we get that, then we won't have any difficulty. In the meantime, though, it should be pointed out that we are drawing staff from surrounding buildings on the evening crew to support the needs here in this building, even though those positions haven't been filled for session.
Okay. Mr. Chair, that reminds me, I probably should have mentioned that we've been under a hiring freeze implemented by the governor in February of last year. Right. Every single opening comes to me. And at this point, every single opening is coming to my entire executive team for approval because we want to ensure that any opening that we're filling is we're filling consistently across our department. So I'll leave plant management now, if that's
okay.
All right. But there's another aspect of plant management, which is a favorite one, and that's parking. That is providing parking and MetroPass services for Capital Area State employees. And in this fund, the expenses that we incur, as you would expect, are lighting, again, energy costs, snow and ice removal, security. We do contract with Capital Security to provide security in our parking ramps. Repairs. We have several ramps that we maintain that are in pretty much constant need of repair. And then maintenance, striping, re-asphalting, other kinds of maintenance. Our customers are, for the most part, state employees, but we do also issue parking passes for vendors and for members of the public. Our press have certain parking passes. They pay the same rates as state employees. This is another case where we must fully recover our costs. That is $3.5 million in total. Debt service, we are still paying for debt service on some of our facilities. I mentioned the capital security. We do spend $339,000, not spend, $339,000 of revenue flows through this account for MetroPass. And then the biggest lion's share is almost $1.9 million for maintenance. I think the question has been raised, of course, do we expect these rates to go up? I'm proud to say that we have not increased parking rates for 2 years, and we do not anticipate increasing them this year coming up. However, we do have some issues. If we have significant workforce reductions, it could lower the demand. We still have to cover our basic costs of the facility. That would be a pressure that we would have to manage. And as I say, our expenses are pretty much fixed, not variable. So it's hard for us to offset any declining revenue. We have had one, it's a very small unit. We've had one FTE reduction in that area. And again, here's a case where energy savings, I think, are coming into play. We've had relighting of some of our facilities with much more energy-efficient lighting. And you can see the savings that we've experienced in the admin ramp, the 14th Street ramp, and the judicial garage. I think that was all I was going to say on parking, unless there are questions.
Just on this, there's probably more that we could always do in various areas. I think about security, and over the interim, a Senate employee's car was stolen from across the street. Senator Rest's assistants right in broad daylight. So there's always things that could be done, but it's I think a sign that we should be more vigilant as to what we can do to help monitor this stuff. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest,
Commissioner, what was really disappointing in that is that there was a camera on that lot. It was fixed. Only looked one way. And I don't know if there wasn't any film in it or it had run out. And so there was as much security on that parking lot as people who go to Home Depot and buy a sign and stick it in their yard and say, my house is, being watched by my sign. And, so when we're paying $335,000 for capital security to monitor our parking lots, we'd say that we didn't get our money's worth in the parking lot across the street at considerable inconvenience to my staff person for the months following the theft of his automobile. Trying to get a new car and getting to work. And
he never got it back?
No. It was one that it's popularly taken apart within moments of it being stolen.
Mr. Chair, Senator sure. Rest, I'm as sympathetic as can possibly be. I think only to say that Capital Security is for us a subcontractor. The $335,000 does go for monitoring those cameras and installing those cameras and maintaining them. It also goes, of course, for the patrolling of the lots and to ensure personal safety of people coming in to and from their cars, and also patrolling the lots, quite frankly, for ticket violations, for people who are parking inappropriately in the lots. So we do get more than just the camera observations for that money, but they are essentially a subcontractor, and the level of service is determined largely in negotiations with the Department of Public Safety, and they've had continued cutbacks, and so I don't want to say we get what we get, but the issues that you might have with camera operation, we should take up with public safety. But we will do that.
Thank you.
Would something like a key-activated gate or anything like that, that might be some cost save? Would that be something that would be within your area or somebody else's?
Mr. Chair, we would implement a key-activated gate, but my suggestion is I don't think a wooden gate as we have over on the state office building would have probably prevented a car from being stolen. Probably would have driven right through it.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
All right, we'll go to the next one.
But Mr. Chairman, but Commissioner Banjero, if that had happened at 9:30 in the morning, someone would probably have noticed as a knocking down a gate. I mean, we could have heard it from our office, as opposed to just being able to get in the car and drive off. I mean, the car was locked, but getting in the car and driving off and it not being in anybody's, not really possible for anybody to observe that. But if they were crashing through a gate or bumping over a curb or something, I would imagine that it would have been noticed at least.
It's quite possible.
Okay.
The next one I'm going to talk about is Central Mail. You'll know when I come back, I'll talk about some general funds for Central Mail. They're in my base general fund budget, which goes toward federal incoming and interoffice mail. But this is a fund, an enterprise fund, that actually is used by state agencies for their bulk mailing. And the money that goes through this fund, a significant amount of money, is essentially the postage. It's a clearing account for the postage that we use to send out your driver's, your automobile registration renewals, your tax refunds, any number of state agency bulk mailings that, in fact, go through this office. Our customers are located all over the city of St. Paul. We do addressing, inserting, folding. We do barcoding. We do all kinds of things that help reduce the postage for state mailings. In fact, notice here at the end of the chart, we save state agencies $800,000 a year as opposed to their doing the mailings themselves without these additional services. So what we've had some variation, obviously, in service. When one obvious one, of course, is that more and more people are going to electronic communications rather than hard paper mailings. And so in some events, I think we will see some decline in this business as more and more electronics. However, we will still send out tax refund checks, and more than likely we will still send out notices of vehicle renewals and the other kinds of things that we put through this office. This is another case. Obviously, in every single one of these, we've had some sort of cost reduction efforts. This is a reduction of a full-time equivalent, one-person reduction. We are also always working with our customers to try to figure out a better and cheaper way to do their mailing. And we've just recently worked with the Department of Public Safety for a postcard mailing, and by resizing the postcard, we will save that agency $20,000 over and above what they would have ordinarily incurred. So, unless there are any questions on mail.
As I recall, if somebody sends something to the Minnesota State Senate, the post office won't deliver it to the Minnesota State Senate. I mean, they have to deliver it to some place that admin manages, and then you sort it out from there. So even if we wanted to try to divide out the postage areas by agency or legislative branch or whatever, the post office won't let us do that. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. They will not deliver to the individual office, even buildings, much less the individual mail stops in each building, which is what we provide as a service. That is our general fund activity, though, here. This is actually a value-added piece of work that we do that helps agencies save money. Our next one is what we used to call risk management. It is our property and casualty insurance. And I think you probably know, but we are basically the in-house insurance company for state government. We offer multiple lines of insurance. We offer property insurance on state-owned buildings and state-owned property, automobile insurance for the state fleet and the fleets of other agencies, a general liability for people's slips and falls and other kinds of liability, and then other. And the other can be a wide variety of things like indemnity. I think we have a small amount of coverage for internet fraud and so forth. It's a lot of money. It's $11.3 million that is paid in premiums by the state agencies and others who participate. And this is the one fund where we have any number of people other than state agencies, executive branch agencies participating. One of our largest single customers is Minsky, where we insure all of their buildings and their fleet. We also offer insurance to a number of counties. Dakota County is a participant in this risk fund, And we think there may be even other opportunities for local units and to join in this fund, and perhaps, and I'll explain in a minute why we think it's probably a good deal for them. We are insuring $10 billion in property, including, again, as I mentioned, all the Minsky facilities. In fiscal year 08, because of favorable claims experience, our management of those claims, our settlement of those claims, we returned to state agencies $1.4 million in a dividend, meaning that their premiums had been were higher than their actual experience across the state. That's equivalent to a 13.6% reduction in the fees that they were paying for state agency insurance. It is kind of a soft market, and insurance is not mandatory. It's not required by state law. We think prudent state agencies will insure their property and their fleets. But as budgets get tight, agencies may choose to take that risk of a catastrophic event themselves. We do reinsure because we don't carry full insurance risk in this fund, so we reinsure for catastrophic events, and we have extremely favorable reinsurance rates. And I think the point of note here is that we do monitor what this costs the state. What is our expense ratio? In other words, what does it cost us to manage this fund versus our losses and our premiums? Our expense ratio is 20.2%, and the industry average for commercial private insurance is 31%. So we believe we're offering a very good deal for the state agencies and others who participate. We still, nonetheless, have had our cost reductions here. We've I'll talk about in a moment the workers' compensation area, which was we inherited from the Department of Employee Relations in that agency breakup. We've been able to merge these two units with some efficiencies in administrative and other support costs. So that has enabled us to reduce a half a person here. We've, in fact, reduced our insurance costs effectively 13.6%, and yet we're still insuring more value. So I think that covers it for insurance.
I got a question about that. If an agency does a very good job, keeps the, you know, monitors things, they don't have any very many insurance claims, at some point, either the executive branch or the legislature is going to say, well, you know, we see some money building up that you're, you know, the administration is going to return to the agencies for doing a good job, and somebody may try to stand in and snatch those, you know, insurance monies for the agencies doing well. But in the downside of that might be they just say, well, we'll just go naked without insurance and see what happens. Do you have any thoughts upon that line?
Well, Mr. Chair, when the premiums are returned to state agencies, they're returned to all funds.
Okay.
So they're not by any means general funds in all cases. We fund any number of federal and other funds. So we would have to return them to not just the general fund. But secondly, I think it would be really not prudent for an agency to be uninsured or self-insured, so to speak, because we have had catastrophic losses. We've had large fires in Minsky facilities. You may remember the tragic automobile accident, van accident that occurred in the state of Michigan with some Minsky students and professors. That happened outside of the state of Minnesota, so the torque cap did not apply. So that was a large catastrophic risk that had to be carried by this fund. So the numbers I'm talking about here do include having to pay from time to time those catastrophic risks. State agency has experienced floods in their buildings. The public safety department experienced a flood. The landlord had some broken pipes. They were fortunately insured through this risk fund, and we were able to pay for the freeze drying of all of their papers, the preservation and restoration of their computers that had been damaged, and that was, again, a fortunate case to having been insured. So we think it's, you know, really prudent for state agencies to carry this insurance, and we've been lucky to have had premium rebates, but that may not be the case next year if, you know, God forbid, we should have a catastrophic risk.
Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, when you said it's a soft market, are you kind of indicating to us that you said there's no law requiring these agencies to, or the Minsky, to carry insurance? Are you telling us that maybe we should draft that law? I mean...
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, you know, all of these businesses I'm talking about here today, I guess except for the fact if you occupy a capital area building, you have to pay us rent. All of these are really voluntary services that we offer. We used to own the management analysis division, and it was not a mandatory use. If you wanted a private consultant, you were certainly free to do so. I think if a state agency wished to insure, I think they would be prudent, and they may be required to use our fund, but they don't have to insure. And so I think we do have extensive marketing efforts. We go out to state agencies and explain the benefits of being a part of this pool, and we extend those marketing efforts and will continue to extend them beyond state agencies. As I mentioned earlier, we think there's some opportunities for counties and local units to participate in this fund.
Follow-up.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned, how does this relate to vehicles, though? Are they fully insured on the vehicles?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rolstein, sure. They are. It is our, as you note here, our 31% of our coverage is on vehicles. We insured MnDOT snowplows. We insure all kinds of state vehicles.
Does that mean that all state vehicles are covered then? Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I'm getting a yes from my fleet manager. Thank you.
And then just one last question, and that with that flood, was that DPS records?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson.
I'm concerned because we're spending $50 million building a new computer system that I believe is going to be in the same – it's not going to be in that same location, is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it is not.
Okay. That's a relief. Thank you.
Okay. Sir Pappas?
Just a quick question, since I didn't realize that some state agencies – could not be insured. Are there ones that are not insured, or are they just not insured with you?
Well, Mr. Chair, the one that comes to mind, and I'm going to have to tax my memory, and we'll get back to you on who is and who isn't. The one that comes to mind is MnDOT. For some of their coverages, they've chosen to be self-insured. However, they use us to adjust their claims. So if they receive a claim, we actually use our adjusters in-house to manage the claim and settle it, and then they pay the cost directly and not out of this fund. But we can get you a list of who is and who isn't insured. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. A related, obviously, business and now conjoined with property and casualty is our workers' comp area. This is a rather large effort that we, again, inherited from the Department of Employee Relations. It pays 2,700 claims annually to state employees. $21 million in claim costs were paid out for workers' injuries. That is actually up $1 million over the preceding year, and that's largely attributable to medical cost inflation. Total of $28.9 million flows through this fund, and, of course, again, it's paid premiums are paid by state agencies. The program costs here are necessarily really out of our control in terms of we're paying third parties for services to our injured state employees. However, part of this group is the safety program for all of state government, and through really aggressive safety programs, we've been able to hold incident rates, that is the accident rates among state employees, relatively steady. We'd hope to see that come down, and now we've had, I think, an accelerated emphasis on safety statewide, an enterprise view of safety, and I would expect that to continue to come down. But you can see medical benefits costs are up 10.7%. Reinsurance costs, where we do have to insure, again, catastrophic claims, are up 24.9%. But again, we've administratively tried to keep our costs low. We've have a 1.5% FTE reduction. And here, once again, if you compare this to the private sector, our expense ratio, cost per $100 of payroll, is 35% compared to 55% average in the private sector. We did. We're able to offer in fiscal year 09 a $600,000 rebate, which effectively lowered costs because of our experience. Now, mostly when we offer these rebates, I wish I could say it was because of incredible efficiency on the part of the Department of Administration. It is a factor of the kind of claims experience that we have. Getting into the smaller ones now, Minnesota's bookstore. I think you know we operate a bookstore. It used to be in the Ford Building, and it's now just east of the Capitol off of University. That bookstore is a storefront, obviously, but its primary business is to partner with state agencies to publish materials that they want to have published. We publish them, we distribute them, we have the supply chain in place to both buy and sell. We have online ordering and online fulfillment. We are currently providing services to 30 state agencies. Obviously, one of our bigger customers is DNR with the state maps. The building codes are also a big seller for this particular unit. We have $1.6 million in sales a year. We are seeing some sales decline. Again, I think here this is the trend toward more electronic publishing. And actually starting out in fiscal 09, we've had a 24% decrease in sales. And I have to say a lot of it has to do with the timing of building code amendments. And if building code amendments are delayed, oftentimes that will affect the revenue of this business significantly. We also publish the state register. I say publish because mostly it is an online publication, but we do publish some paper copies. Some are filed with the Legislative Reference Library, and we have a few subscriptions. The main revenue for this, however, is that we charge state agencies a per-page fee as we have to format and set and then publish their rulemaking, their notices of procurement opportunities, and so forth. And we were able to obtain a reduction in that page rate from $144 a page to $136 because we were able to work out an arrangement with Thompson West whereby we have licensed some of the material to them. So that helped reduce our costs. State register or bookstore? Okay, Office Supply Connection. Some of you may not know that we have a warehouse of office supplies. Again, just over here on 321 Grove to the other side of 35E. It stocks and sells office supplies to state agencies. We do have a few stocked products. Paper and toner are big sellers, and agencies want quick delivery of those. But mostly we have deliveries fulfilled through a third-party fulfillment house. We sell $6.7 million worth of office supplies. I should probably digress here for just a moment and say there was a Drive to Excellence project initiative just a year or two ago, 2 years, 3 years ago, which reduced vastly the number of office supply choices that you have. By reducing the catalog, we got better prices on what we were selling, and we were able to significantly reduce by about $1 million a year the costs of the materials that we were supplying to state agencies. We're real proud of our 100% recycled paper. We offer it at prices equal to or less than 30% recycled paper, so we can encourage state agencies to use 100% recycled. We, too, have seen a sales decline in this business. Again, people are probably exhausting their office supply cabinets rather than ordering more. We're also experiencing an 8% sales decline. We have had a FTE reduction, almost three people reduction. We're doing more with three fewer people, not more, but we're doing certainly almost the same volume. But I do want to say here that we have pending a request for proposal to see if there is not a private sector lower cost alternative for this particular method of delivering office supplies.
I had a question on that, Commissioner. For instance, Senator Kubley's area, would the state agency be better off to just find some local vendor to provide their toners and their paper rather than having to contact somebody in St. Paul to send it up?
Mr. Chair, that is, of course, one of the issues. The stuff does come out of St. Paul in many cases, and we have to transport it to the state agency, so that's one factor in our costs that we want to look at. However, I will say that as compared with a local supplier or even as compared with a big box, right now the prices that we are offering are lower because we have the volume and because we've had good negotiations with the vendors. That's something we have to obviously evaluate. This is an area where we want to make sure we're offering the very lowest cost alternative for state agencies. It's not a lot of money, but it's an area where we have the ability to manage it, and so we will. At the moment, our prices, though, are lower, significantly lower than catalog prices and, as I said, significantly lower than a big box price.
So the agencies in greater Minnesota, imagine some are just probably mailed to them, or do they send vehicles down here to pick up their supplies, or how do we service them?
It's both.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Sir Olsen.
I was wondering about, is this something that is now or could be opened up to like school districts or other government agencies to purchase? Because it seems like you're right, there must be an awful lot of buying power there.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Olsen, I'll digress for a moment and talk about our cooperative purchasing venture. We have, under state law, local units, school districts have the ability to buy off of state contracts through our cooperative purchasing venture. We have roughly 81 of 83 school districts who have signed up to participate in that program. We have about one-third of the counties and a few little less than that of the cities. We used to charge a fee. It was a $500 fee to participate in this program every year. We've been able to find enough efficiencies that we no longer charge the fee. So it's now free for these local units and other units of government to buy off of state contract, and we also have expanded it to nonprofits. We have a number of private colleges and universities who are now buying off of those contracts for just exactly the reason you mentioned. We get huge economies of scale and volume, pricing leverage.
Mr. Chair, what was the number of school districts you said?
It's 81 out of 83. They're participating in the program. That does not necessarily say that they are buying anything and everything off of the state contracts. We don't have good data for who's buying what.
Your numbers have been pretty good, but there's about 400 school districts. So 81.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was counties. I was 81 out of 83 counties. With respect to school districts, it's really less than one-third.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Office Supply Connection.
Yep.
Fleet. You know that there are actually 5 state fleets. The fleet that's managed by the Department of Administration are those cars that you generally see driving down the road with the state of Minnesota on the side. We have 1,750 of those cars. We basically buy those cars and lease them to state agencies for their use. They pay us monthly lease fees. We have life cycle management of those vehicles, maintenance management, fuel management, and our customers, again, are both state agencies and local units of government, and metropolitan agencies and others. So we will say that we've been going through a downsizing of the state fleet. This particular fleet is 8.7% smaller than it used to be. State agencies are cutting back on their use of cars, and I will say overall the state fleet has declined almost 20%. In this particular time. We are seeing vehicles being returned because they're not affordable and as agencies cut discretionary expenses. So we will expect to see more of those coming through. We will first try to reassign those cars to other agencies for their needs. And then, of course, we surplus them eventually, and I'll talk about surplus in a moment. One thing that we've been doing under the Drive to Excellence project is installing a system that actually keeps much better track of all of the cars in the state fleet. We used to not really have a good handle on mileage-driven maintenance cycles and so forth, and now we have the system in place, and we can show state agencies that they're vastly underutilizing a car, and once shown that data, you'd be surprised. Agencies say, I don't want that car anymore. I don't want a car that's only being driven 7,000 miles a year. It's really not affordable. So the more we provide this information to state agencies, it's another one of our services. We find them actually eliminating cars from their fleet. We did, in terms of...
Go ahead, Senator Rossi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, if they eliminate the car, do they pay mileage to somebody to drive their own car, or what's happening?
For sure.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, yes, and so it's a careful cost trade-off that the agency has to make in terms. But the real question is the car being used? Are the miles being driven? Whether they're being driven in a state car or being driven in a personal car, and if you're driving a car less than 10,000 miles a year, it probably isn't cost effective for the agency to be leasing that car.
Thanks.
We have had cost containment in this area as well, and our biggest single issue is that our biggest single item of cost savings is we moved this built business from leased space in South St. Paul to our owned space in Arden Hills. We've owned the surplus operation in Arden Hills, and we've merged the two, thinking that now we have a cradle-to-grave car ownership. We could take the car in, we provide it to the agency, and at the end of life, we surplus it through that operation. So we were able to close down that office, merge staff. We have had some administrative expense savings because of that and other efficiencies. We did eliminate our repair shop, and we are now relying extensively or exclusively on the private sector for our repairs.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, we'll see.
You know, that strikes me. I'm in the trucking business, and we do truck repairs. We hopefully work for a profit, although they claim we're a nonprofit. The thing that I never can understand about that, it's kind of the debate between a school district owning their fleet or leasing the fleet. And my perspective on that is you're sending a vehicle out to be repaired, somebody's making money on that, whereas if it's internal, you're working on a break-even. And so I don't quite understand how that cash flows for you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olstein, there probably is a wage differential between the state employee wage and the private sector wage. That's for starters. But secondly, over time, we used to have a large maintenance shop right over here on Robert Street where the revenue building sits currently. And we maintained and washed cars, and that was in my prior tenure in this job. That was gradually downsized to the point that we really only had one or two people working on repairs. In fact, basically what they were doing was prepping cars as they came in to send out to the agencies. We did not have economy of scale. The cars, and that shop was in St. Paul, and the cars were all over the state of Minnesota, and we just found it to be much more cost-effective. I have our fleet manager here, however. If there are all kinds of burning questions about fleet, he's probably a better person to answer than I. So, I don't know, Tim, do you want to respond to that?
Welcome to the Budget Vision.
Thank you. My name is Tim Morris. I work for the Department of Administration as the Division Director of the Fleet and Surplus Services Division. The state buys very many different types of vehicles. I'm primarily in the passenger car and light duty end of the business, but we get vehicles from Chrysler, we get vehicles from Ford, we get vehicles from General Motors, and keeping our mechanics trained and keeping the proper equipment in a shop is very expensive. We were having a lot of difficulty keeping the training, keeping the people trained, and be able to repair the vehicles efficiently and with the different makes that we get.
Well, I've got a question. You know, we all wind up in the situation where we say, well, should I squeeze one more year out of my car, recognizing that the maintenance and the costs are going up to do that, or is it time now to just cut my losses and get a new car? And when you're dealing with 1,750 cars, you know, that multiplies. So, you know, how, what kind of challenges are you facing deciding, you know, when, what to repair, what to, you know, buy new when you're dealing with this kind of a fleet?
That is a challenge. We are not an operation that uses vehicles in one particular way. They're used in many different ways. The Department of Commerce uses them differently than the Department of Agriculture, and they use them differently than Natural Resources or the Department of Transportation. And you, the way that we do it is we look at each individual application and we anticipate what the life cycle is going to be when we acquire the vehicle. We work with the agency to determine what we think the proper life cycle is going to be. A typical one would be 5 years and 90,000 miles. As we get into the life of the vehicle, we then check back with the vehicle to see how it's doing. Is it actually being driven the amount of miles that are anticipated? Is the vehicle performing the way that we anticipate it will and the way that the agency needs it to? And we adjust life cycles as we go. So it's an ongoing question that we address throughout the life of the vehicle. We balance the cost against the reliability and try to come up with the best solution for getting state business done.
Sir Olstein, did you have another question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morris, if you've got 1,700 vehicles of all different varieties, are you negotiating a labor rate with the facilities that are repairing them, or are you having them repaired at their standard labor rate, or how does that work?
Mr. Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, yes and no. It depends on where the vehicle is. We try to make the repair as convenient for the driver so we can get back to work as possible. However, we do negotiate with Ford on a broad scale for labor through Ford Motor Company at Ford dealerships, for example. So no matter what Ford dealership we go into, we can get a standard rate.
Senator Dunbar, do you have a question?
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just really struck by the five-year 90,000 mile because most vehicles today are designed to last somewhere between 150 and 200,000 miles without major repairs. And I've not been able to personally own something that in 5 years I don't get 200,000 miles on it. But do you have statistical data that would suggest that that's the right time to get rid of it? Because it just doesn't seem like the way cars go these days, it seems like you still got a lot of usable life left in them at that point.
And Mr. Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We try to align ourselves with what the rest of the states are doing and take everybody's collective experience. And, yes, there are some cases that they do go longer. Life cycles range anywhere from probably 120,000 miles down to probably 70 in the smallest scale, but it depends again on how you're using the vehicle and what the agency needs to accomplish with it. A typical long life vehicle would, from our perspective, would be a law enforcement vehicle where they're putting on maybe 30,000 miles a year, and you can put on a lot of miles quite rapidly. On the shorter mileage end, you may have a vehicle that's assigned to a state park that doesn't go very far, but it's used maybe to haul trash and to do other kinds of maintenance type of work. The 5-year 90,000 was kind of an average, but it is something that we review regularly.
Yes, Sarah Jobar?
Again, thank you. I'm just kind of confused by the whole thing, I guess, in a way. I just went to, and I know the state has some hybrid vehicles. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay, because I just went with the Toyota Camry hybrid, and it was because Toyota has a lot of statistical data that their hybrids are making at 200,000 miles as well. The reason I didn't go with the Ford is Ford has only been able to last their batteries for 100,000, and the batteries are $7,000. So again, I'm kind of finding it troubling that we're not, you know, utilizing those vehicles as long as we could, because even at having dealt in the wholesale market on cars for a number of years, that was always my winter job. There's not a lot of value difference between a car with 90,000 miles and a car with 130 or 140,000 miles today, meaning you wouldn't lose a lot in waiting that difference to get rid of them. So again, I'm hoping that you could provide us possibly with some of that statistical data that this is the right time to get rid of these, that you're actually coming out ahead for the state, because it just doesn't seem right to me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, we will provide information. It's our effort to, it's our goal to try to provide reliable transportation for state employees, and that's what we balance against the longer life. If we have vehicles that are down for repairs or down regularly for repairs, that cuts into the efficiency of doing state business, and it's a balance between longer life and reliability.
And the Department of Administration will be back after the governor's proposals are out, so we'll have a better idea. So maybe we can, you know, tie some of this new information in when we have them back at a later date. Sarah Limmer, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morris, when we buy cars and vehicles, do we buy extended warranties?
Mr. Morris?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we get the manufacturer's standard warranty that comes with the vehicle.
And what are they in at least mileage length? Do they get to that 95,000 when we sell off the car?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, typically not. Typically it's 3 years on 36,000 miles. Some of them are longer now.
Mr. Morris, is it better to buy an extended warranty and then let the dealer fix the car as we own it? And then when we get to whatever that magic mileage marker is, and then the warranty is done, and we go buy another car with an extended warranty, wouldn't that save us some money?
Of course.
Mr. Chairman, members, we've found that by managing what maintenance is done on the vehicle, we can come out more cost-effectively doing the maintenance than buying the extended warranty. On a personal note, if I were going to personally lease a car, I think I would probably lease it for the term of the warranty. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a side note, though.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Morris, I know a constituent's going to ask me this, so I'm going to ask you the question. If a constituent wanted to buy a used state vehicle, would it be better to buy a highway patrol car or a park vehicle?
Well, actually, we're getting a surplus services in a minute.
Coming up.
So maybe hold that question for a minute. I think Commissioner Badgerill can tell you that answer. Senator Jarbar?
Well, I guess I just can't seem to leave this one alone, and I'm not trying to extend it, but are we analyzing the type of vehicles we buy? Because, again, it just seems like, I put an inordinate amount of miles on vehicles, and I can only say that, you know, the last 7 brand new ones I bought, I had 2 that actually had any problems before 100,000 miles. And so it doesn't, either we're not buying the right vehicles if we have to change them over or things, because if we're utilizing them in areas where we're putting a lot of road miles on, again, today's manufacturers are telling us they're building for 150 or 200,000 trouble-free miles. And if we're having trouble before that, maybe we're not buying the right product. Are we analyzing that sort of thing?
Ms. Morse?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the vehicles that we purchase, first of all, I think that we're buying good vehicles. I think that we're buying the best vehicles that we can. The vehicles that we purchase by statute, need to meet certain mileage rate criteria or be able to run on flex fuel. So it isn't the whole spectrum of vehicles that we choose from. It's from the spectrum that meets the flex fuel need or the high mileage requirements. Excuse me, but I do think that we are buying quality vehicles.
So we'll see.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morris, having our family used to buy a lot of cars off the state auction, and we just junked two this fall. One had 242,000 on it, and so we had years of life after the state was done with it. So Senator Jungbar is bringing up an interesting point, and I remember.
You should be grateful.
Yes, thank you, because we got some pretty cheap transportation out of those cars, and oh great, now I lost my train of thought. No, I'm thinking that his point about the difference between $90,000 and $150,000 on the book value of those cars, I realize the state gets value selling a car that's in good shape under 100,000 miles, gets a pretty good – those auctions, for the buyer, it's a good value, and the state's getting pretty good money too, I believe. But as we're facing this budget crisis, it seems to me that really is something that we – probably should be looking at is that running those vehicles more miles, it just gets cheaper operational costs. You're getting less probably at the sale, but I think you're getting also a cheaper per mile, I would assume.
Mr. Chair, I think we clearly owe you an analysis of justifying that particular
It sounds like an area that they're interested in. So.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Okay, let's proceed. Limick.
We've got LIMIC, Land Management Information Center. I'll be back again talking about the general fund for this activity here in a few weeks. But this is, in fact, the Internal Service Fund. It's about $700,000 a year. We do here GIS, Geographic Information Systems Consulting, for state agencies. And actually, also, we enter into contracts and grants with the federal government and local governments. 75% of our clients are, however, state agencies. Basically, we are experts in geographic information systems where many state agencies are not, and they buy our expertise under interagency agreements, and that's basically the sum total of this business. It is a business that is, I would have to say, declining in terms of usage by state agencies. At this point, it's looking pretty good for this year. You know, we analyze all of these businesses for their viability. And this business right now, we're looking at about 98% of our business plan having been booked as of January, which is good since we only have 6 months left. We have been reducing costs here and staff as our business has declined. So this is a business that I would say we will continue to watch. We are maintaining, as usual, a two-month cash reserve for should the business continue to decline. Finally, surplus services. We mentioned it briefly. This is a business where we were able to reduce.
Okay, sir, Jungbar.
I wanted to stop at LIMIC again, if we could. We're talking about support to state, federal, local governments. I spent a good deal of time trying to figure out a lot of the services that they have to offer, and it's some really good stuff. I'm wondering, have we looked at being able to market LIMIC's information to other outside sources? Because I look at this particular area of government as a potential revenue generator for a lot of things. So I'm wondering if we've analyzed those sorts of things.
Well, I'm always encouraging these businesses, goading them, I guess I might say, to do more marketing. This is a case where the people who are running the business are, in fact, GIS experts in themselves, and it's always a balance. How much do they do the real technical work, and how much do they spend of their time out marketing? This is a case in this business, though, where we have encouraged them to do more marketing.
And for members, if you haven't seen the things that they offer and the high technical information, and their people are phenomenal. I mean, they're just excited about what they do, and they can show you things that I think would be a great value to the private industry and stuff as well. So I really look at this as an underutilized area of government that potentially could generate a lot of outside sales of that information.
We appreciate that. Thank you. Surplus service, as I mentioned, is the last one. We've reduced our fees. You know, we take the state property or state agency and other agency property. We sell it, and we charge a small administrative fee. We were able to reduce those administrative fees for this year. Basically, again, here, this is more and more in the interest of the environment and efficiency, we are encouraging reuse of state property, and we've been quite successful at that. It is a $1.2 million internal service fund. Much more money flows through the account than that through the surplus sales. We, in fact, returned $7 million in sales proceeds to state agencies in fiscal 08. A good part of that was cars, but we also sell any number of other kinds of surplus property, computers, furniture, and so forth. We also are the state agency or the agency within Minnesota that distributes federal property. And $1.8 million worth of federal property was distributed to nonprofits and others for their reuse. We're not sure whether we're going to see more or less surplus property as a result of state agency downturns. As agencies downsize, I suppose they'll be getting rid of their computers and furniture. But it's hard to know what the impact will be. But here, again, we have had several efficiencies. Here we've merged with Fleet, the administrative savings. We do have a new online auction tool, and if you have not had an opportunity to visit it, I encourage you to. It is an eBay-like auction tool that offers much more flexibility and much more user-friendliness to the public in buying state agency property. If you'll go to the Department of Administration website, I don't have the site right with me, but just, in fact, if you Google state auction, Minnesota State Auction, you will go to that site. So that's one of our new efficiencies. Rather than waiting for our 11 times a year auction at Arden Hills, this enables us to move the property much more quickly, getting the money back into the state agency hands. That covers the internal service funds.
I've got a question about, you mentioned computers. OET is going to be in here on Monday, but they've told us that their guidance is that to try to expect about a seven-year cycle out of computers. So the excess computers you're selling, are those just agencies downsizing, or are those agencies that are just wanting to have newer computers more often than the guidelines?
It's both.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, I'm Holly Gessner. I'm the Assistant Director at Fleet and Plus Services. In regards to your question as far as computers, most computers are purchased with a warranty of some type on them, a maintenance warranty. At some point, it can be 2 years, 5 years, 7 years. State agencies have at some point determined their years of their life cycle and then bring them into surplus services.
So I think in some we see all ages. I was a little bit surprised when I heard that factoid from the Office of Enterprise Technology, because I know that we do have some newer computers than 7 years that we are selling through surplus.
And somebody wants a computer that's over 7 years old then? Is it, you know, with Windows 98?
Mr. Chair, I'm very surprised that we have, because the computers are really hot items. Right. We do wipe them clean, obviously, yeah, so that there's no remaining state data on the computers. But they do move fast, and there are some pretty good buys, I think, for computers and ancillary equipment, printers and so forth.
And as to Senator Limmer's question, if somebody wants to buy a car, should they buy one that's been driven into the ground or one that's driven only on Sundays? What should they do? So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think there are some good bargains to be had in state surplus.
So kick the tires well. Okay.
Yeah.
She could be a salesman in that car lot. They're all good deals.
Okay. They are.
Any other questions about the non-general fund items? We do have two other items that we're going to be covering here. So any other questions? Okay.
I will just say to that point, really, state agencies, we encourage them to come to surplus first when they have a need for additional office furniture or other kinds of equipment, because we have a good inventory. And I think more and more, obviously, with budget pressures, agencies are doing that, because we first want a state agency to use them before we sell them to the public. Okay, I have two other items to cover, and they are basically along the lines of good news, updates on programs that we've talked to you about before. The first one I want to talk to you about is Enterprise Lean. This is a program that you generously funded last year in our budget, in our Performance Improvement Fund. And we have a very small staff that has started. We've been at this project for about a year. Lean, just in brief, is the Toyota production method. It is a way of managing processes that takes out waste. So we have thousands, hundreds of thousands of processes in state government, and I will guarantee you that every single one of them has some element of that process that is unnecessary. And all this does is we teach people in state agencies to go examine their process carefully and reduce unnecessary steps in that process. Now, you have to provide a few tools and techniques, and we have thus far trained 80 people, and we'll have another 20 going through our training here in January, all throughout state agencies. Our goal originally was to have six agencies adopting Lean as one of their as their primary process improvement tool in 6 months. Well, we've way far exceeded that. We are now at 18 state agencies who are embracing Lean, and we're also providing Lean services to MinSCU and the U of M, who are sending people to our training. But if you see some of the success stories, it is not unusual to see 60 or 70 or 80% of the time or steps taken out of a process. And we've included just a couple here. We've reduced from 5 business days to 4 business days the time for Veterans Affairs to process veterans' applications for aid. 97% faster personal care attendant registration. And there are can't think of how many tens of thousands of personal care attendants there are in the state, but now a personal care attendant can be licensed much, much quicker. You can get your birth certificate at the Department of Health in 1 day, whereas it used to take extensively longer than that. And you'll see some of the other Lean results. We do have a Lean website that reports all of these results, and I dare to say at this point we are the leader among all states in implementing Lean as a process improvement technique to improve how we are doing things. It improves things for the citizen. We've had agencies who have been able to say that we're not having to fill a position because they have so improved their process. So it's just a good news story. It's a relatively small investment. It's 1.5 people that manage this program. The real investment is in the state agency's employees' time who go through our training, and then without use of consultants, they go do these process improvements themselves. And it is taking off like wildfire. Another one that comes to mind is the Vets Home in Minneapolis, which had some issues with medication dispensing. They used a Lean process to foolproof their process for dispensing medication. They are very strong advocates for the Lean process. So I wanted to just give you an update on that. And another project which we brought to you in the last biennium was establishment of the Office of Grants Management. And that office has also been wildly successful. It's been going for just about a year and 3 or 4 months. And the basic purpose of this office, and I have our director here if you have questions, but basically this is to standardize and streamline the grant-making process across all state agencies. You probably know every agency and sometimes every program within every agency has a different way of issuing grants, sometimes a different grant agreement form. And we got an Office of Legislative Auditor audit, as you may remember, some time ago, which found these practices and cited agencies for their lack of consistency in business discipline in grant making. This office, working with all of the grant makers in all state agencies, is working to improve that situation. So as of today, we have 11 policies on the management of grants, which never existed before. So there is a uniform way around management of the finances of your grantee, around conflict of interest, around the need for a written agreement in your grants. In addition, we've established 2 websites. One website is a public-facing website, so if I'm a nonprofit and I want a grant around a particular subject, childcare, for example, I may use the keyword search, and this will tell me where grants are currently available in any state agency around childcare. I can search by state agency name, by subject topic, and so forth. So it's a great service for the nonprofit community. Secondly, there's an internal website. We have, I don't know how many hundreds of people doing grants, Kristen knows, I'm sure, doing grants in state agencies, many of whom only do 1 or 2 grants a year. So they are not experts. So this internal website provides them resources, tools, checklists, standard form agreements for them to go to and systematize and standardize their issuance of grants. We're doing training.
We've worked with the nonprofit community. We've worked extensively with the Minnesota Council for Nonprofits, who has been involved in the development of all of our policies. It is one person office, and I say it's the best bargain in state government. So I just wanted to give you an update. We have more to come. There are more policies to be issued. You'll see some next steps. We want to work with Minnesota nonprofits and foundations so that we can better align the spending of the state with these nonprofits for greater impact. We do eventually, our goal, our dream, would be to establish an online grants system. There are one or two other such systems in the United States where, in fact, all of your grant transaction is done online. No paper processing. A nonprofit goes in, fills out a simple form. That is your grant application. It is then monitored and managed online. Payments are made and authorized online, and it eliminates a lot of bureaucracy around grants. We hope to develop the requirements for that system, and maybe someday when we're in a position to be able to fund that kind of system, we would be back to ask you for those resources. Obviously, lien is important in grants as well. Grants is a process that is subject to lien. Our grant management director has gone through lien training and has offered herself as a facilitator for any state agency that has a grant issue or want a grant process to be leaned out. She's done one such grant process lien technique, or Kaizen event, as we call them, with the Department of Public Safety so far. So there's more training to come. The websites will be further developed. I just wanted to give you an update that the office is up and running and doing terrific work.
Well, Commissioner, when the legislative auditor found that we really had an inconsistent and, in some cases, very sloppy means of managing the grants, and we wanted to do it, but we didn't really have the funds to do it, so the proposal was to kind of skim off a little bit off the grants and help fund that, and we could only do it for a year. How's the funding of the office looking? Is that something that's coming?
Mr. Chair, I can just give you the facts about the current biennium. It was funded for the first year of the biennium. It was not funded for the second year. And I think it's testimony to the fact that agencies believe in the need for this office because state agencies contributed a little bit here, $10,000 here, $5,000 there, to enable the office to continue for the second year of the biennium.
Any questions on anything that the Commissioner's gone through? Okay, do you have anything further, Commissioner?
Well, Mr. Chair, I feel remiss. My financial director, Lenora Madigan, was here, and I didn't rely on her. I was afraid you were really going to get into detailed financial questions, which I couldn't answer, but she could.
Those will come. Those will come. We wanted to get the big picture here today. Any other questions before we turn? Next week, on Monday, we will be looking at the Office of Enterprise Technology and getting an update on what they're up to. Wednesday, of course, is going to be the legislative conference, so we will not be meeting next Wednesday. So if there's nothing further, the meeting's adjourned. Thank you. Welcome back, everybody. Okay. Always a